for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. My name is Anna.
And I'm Sam.
And before we dive into our lore-packed episodes this week, we want to give a brief shout-out to the unofficial sponsor of this episode, Astro Coffee, because we were waiting in line to get breakfast burritos, and Sam was getting coffee, and he was like, yeah, we're going to go record our cool weekly Star Wars podcast, and the Astro Coffee man was like, please have a free bag of coffee from Astro Coffee.
So this episode brought to you by Astro Coffee, our local coffee truck, which gave us free coffee.
Our wiggles and giggles this week are fueled by Astro Coffee, and we wouldn't have it any other way.
But like you said, we got some lore-packed episodes, so let's get right into it.
Yeah, this week we are covering Rebels Season 3, Episodes 3 and 4, The Holocrons of Fate.
Dun, dun, dun.
And The Antilles Extraction.
Ta-da, dun.
Which I'm still unclear about, so we will talk about it. But
right.
First, the Holocrons of Fate. Kanan and Ezra intercept a rebel transponder that has been brutally attacked. Everyone is dead on the floor except for one captain who is dying.
It's one of the Hammerhead class ships that Leia Organa delivered to them, and it is smoking in,
space.
Oh, no. I
know,
yeah.
See, that's the thing about these episodes. You watch these episodes, and you're like, okay, cool, those were episodes. And then you find out one fact that changes everything. And then you do that again and again and again.
This is true.
So that's devastating. I hate that. Leia worked really hard to get those hammerheads to the rebellion.
She did.
Anyway, the dying captain on the floor says the ghost is in danger from a red blade. And when Ezra and Kanan call Hera to warn her, she has already been captured by Maul.
Mm-hmm.
Maul holds the entire ghost crew hostage until Kanan and Ezra agree to show up at a rendezvous with not only the Sith holocron, but also the Jedi holocron that belongs to Kanan. To which they're like, cool, we can give you the Jedi holocron. Bendu, can we have the Sith holocron back? So they have to travel back to Attilan and ask Bendu where the Sith holocron is, and Bendu has hidden it where else but in a den of spiders.
I mean, there's really not much to Attilan other than Bendu and spiders. So.
Yeah. So Bendu is like, you must travel into the den of spiders to find the holocron, to which they're like, fair, are you really a deity if you didn't make an object lesson out of a mundane task? So.
Well, the Bendu also makes it all about balance between them because they are in conflict. Ezra really is like, I don't care what this Sith holocron's going to do, because the Bendu reveals that when one brings together and opens a Sith holocron and a Jedi holocron, they learn a true fact. And they can never unlearn it.
Yeah, they get just galaxy warping levels of knowledge that can never be unknown.
Yeah.
So he's like, cool, if you want that, go into the spider den with the power of friendship, which they do.
Spoiler alert, they do.
It actually is very beautiful because Ezra goes down first by himself because he's trying to protect Kanan and compensate for Kanan's blindness because mm-hmm. he feels like it's his fault. But Ezra has not learned the lesson of pacifism, which is the secret to dealing with the spiders. So Kanan actually goes down too and is protecting Ezra and counseling him. And then they have to work together to force lift the holocron off of the backs of...
like a dozen sleeping spiders. They're worshiping it.
Yeah, that's the vibe that I picked up on. It's a weird scene.
It is weird.
But it is very beautiful because Kanan keeps Ezra calm. Ezra helps Kanan. They hug it out. They forgive each other. They walk back out. And Bendu is like, peace out, Girl Scouts. I don't think this is a good idea, but also I am an ambiguous balance deity, and I don't care. you're welcome.
Yeah. He's like, you'll never be able to tell me I didn't warn you, because I have warned you, and that is the end of this conversation.
Yeah. Speaking of the Jedi holocron, mm-hmm. Maul is keeping the specters hostage on the ghost. He separates Hera from the pack and makes her give him a tour of the ghost household.
Yes.
And then finds Kanan's room because it is the boringest one. Mm-hmm. And he's like, boy, I wonder where a Jedi would hide an extremely powerful confidential holocron, probably in his bedside drawer.
Which is, in fact, where it is. Yeah. But he also gets that by pulling the information painfully from Hera, including Kanan's real name, Caleb Doom.
Caleb Doom? Which we will come back to.
Yes.
Because I had realizations. So the Jedi Knight, formerly known as Caleb Doom, appears with Ezra at the rendezvous point, and Maul promptly leads Ezra away and tosses Kanan out of the airlock, literally traumatizing. He's fine.
He jumps back in and then rescues the ghost crew.
Yeah, feelings hurt, skin freezer burned, apprentice uncovering the secrets of the galaxy, but completely functional and fine, and he rescues the ghost crew. But Ezra and Maul sit down together, unlock the holocrons, join them together, and bring each of their questions to this blinding light circle of infinite knowledge. Ezra wants to know how to destroy the Sith, mm-hmm. and Maul wants hope, question mark.
Yes, he is looking for hope because that is the way he delivers all of his answers.
In cryptic one-word responses. So there are blinding sheets of light in every direction as the two holocrons merge. The specters come up on the two seated Force users just in time to hear Maul and Ezra both finding something. Ezra says out loud, twin sons, mm-hmm. and Maul says out loud, he lives.
Yep.
And then Kanan wades in, tells Ezra it's not worth it, snap out of it. There is a huge flash of light, big explosion. Everyone's knocked out. Maul stumbles to his ship saying, he lives! Mm-hmm. And Ezra wakes up and tells Kanan, I saw a bunch of stuff. I don't know.
The whole universe.
I saw the whole universe. I don't know what it means. I don't have any cliff notes for you. I'm not sure what I saw. Mm-hmm. And Kanan says, I'm sure we'll figure it out together.
So nothing traumatic or harrowing about that episode.
Or mysterious.
But let's move on to the Antilles Extraction, Season 3, Episode 4.
Tell me what's up.
So in this one, we start off with a bunch of rebels dying. An entire flight of A-Wings is shot down by a bunch of TIE Interceptors. I don't know if we've seen TIE Interceptors before.
I think I read that this is their first appearance.
Well, they are sexy.
Which ones are those?
They're the ones with the bent wings. So normal TIE fighters have big hexagonal cracker wings on the side, and these ones have bent, narrow, pointy wings with a gap in the middle and four lasers instead of two.
Rad. Cool.
Yeah. And one of them has red stripes on it, but they are just shattering through rebel convoys and it is not great.
Yeah, it's a mercy mission and they are merciless.
Indeed. However, back on Atalon, everyone's like, well, this sucks. And Sato says, we got a message from Fulcrum. And Ezra's like, Ahsoka's alive? And they're like, afraid not. Fulcrum is a code name used by several people. And this is the message we received. There are Imperial defectors at the Skystrike Academy that we should find a way to get out.
Which is like, I think, the elite flight academy of the Empire.
It is. It is the top gun for Imperial pilots. So Ezra's like, I volunteer. And they're like, Ezra, you are too famous to volunteer. Sabine is up. She actually has been an Imperial cadet before.
And because she changes her hair every 6 months, nobody knows who she is.
It's a secret. So Sabine enters this Imperial Flight Academy and starts going along. Kanan and Ezra are in a blockade runner sort of at the outsides of the system, waiting for the pickup. But Sabine goes in and she meets her new wingman, whose nickname is Wedge, and they're on a flight mission, and they're basically in the same mission that just happened at the beginning of the episode. Hey, here's a burning, unarmed transport. Blow it up. And they're like, is this Imperial doctrine? And then a VCX-100 comes up and yeets them out of their little pods. You have been defeated. Please insert 25 cents to continue.
The Empire literally coded the ghost whooping Imperial butt into their simulations.
Well, in fact,
hilarious.
Who's piloting it? It's Volt Scaris, commandant of the Imperial Skystrike Academy, who is an ace pilot and has cool red stripes on his TIE interceptor.
Oh, that's who that is.
Yes. We learn his last name, but not his first name. Anyway, he is like, you must be merciless. If you don't pay attention to the rules, then you will die. And Sabine is still trying to figure out who the defectors are, but she comes across Wedge and Hobby and Rake, who are all sitting there like, hey, we need to escape. I'm not enjoying myself. I'm not having fun anymore here.
I came here to do good for the galaxy and blow stuff up, and we're all out of good for the galaxy.
Oh, gosh. You put it like that. It's terrible. Another complication is that Governor Price, flanked by ISB agent Callis, roll up saying, we've heard reports that there's a defector here. And Price is like, Callis, I know you are actually a professional detective who wears body armor everywhere you go. I'm going to show you how it's done, which is...
He really does.
It's more than a little insulting to Callis, but...
He handles it very gracefully. He is a changed man, Sam. The power of love has transformed Agent Callis.
Well, don't get ahead of ourselves. So the game plan for Price is to send all of the TIE fighters out to do a simulated dogfight. Their guns have been turned off. And so they all go out on this simulated dogfight. And then Ezra and Kanan show up, and Sabine and Hobby and Rake and Wedge take off and head right towards the blockade runner. And Price is like, haha, you have fallen into my trap. Your wings are now disassembled.
And then her wings fell off.
Yeah, exactly. She's like, I peel your wings off like a sociopath with butterflies. And then she's like, kill one of them. And Rake dies in a hail of gunfire. And they almost blow up Ezra and Kanan's blockade runner and are recaptured.
Yeah, brutal.
So then we cut to the classic room right down the hallway in all Imperial bases, the torture room. And we learn that Sabine is Sabine, and she is the leader of all of this. And she's going to be personally tortured by Governor Price.
Yeah, they're about to torture Wedge. And she's like, hold up, I'm the rebel. So they lead Wedge and Hobby away. And Sabine is like, joke's on you. I am untorturable because of my ninja skills.
She ninjas her way out of that. Since Governor Price into her own torture machine. And then as Wedge and Hobby are like, we need to come up with a plan, Sabine opens the door and is like, are you ready?
They're like, we're rescuing you. She's like, you are cute. And
let's go.
That's it.
That's cute. This time they escape in a TIE bomber. But before they do,
how do they escape, Sam?
They're blocked into a hallway, and around the corner comes ISB agent Callis, hands up saying, don't shoot.
I'm on your side.
Go this way to get to the hangar. Tell Garazeb Aurelius we're even.
Kalazev is canon. Kalazev is canon. I screamed. I squealed like a little girl.
And then they escape in a TIE bomber, and they are nearly shot to pieces by Volt Scaris in a TIE interceptor, but just in time, everyone escapes. And these two new ace pilots show up at the rebellion.
Yeah, a lot of work for two pilots, I'm not going to lie.
Well, you know, I was reading about this in an interesting context. Let's just dive right into that real fast because it's a little side hustle point. So in the current Ukraine war, there is someone, and I read like an interview with him, and he remained nameless, but they talked about how at least 75% of kills are inflicted by like 10% of the warfighters.
Whoa.
Yeah. Like,
so your bad batch.
Yeah. Your bad batch and your like your combat aces, right? Because in World War II, for example, there were Russian and German pilots who had like 300 air to air kills. And that means that like other dudes were trained and flew up in their A-wings. And this dude's like, yep, there's five. There's six of them dead. There's 100 of them dead. Like just hundreds and hundreds of them. So one good pilot is worth a lot. But the idea of a particular warrior being like one of the best of the best is really important. And especially for fighter pilots, because they are great trainers.
So what you're saying is that it was worth it to break these two hotshots out of Hotshot Academy because they might be the top 10%?
They might be the top 0.1%.
Mm.
And it didn't cost them much. Like, they had to weld some pieces back onto the blockade runner, but that's it. Because they were going to lose they lost the original, six A-wings and transport anyway. So it wasn't an expensive thing. It was a dangerous thing, but they netted two pilots and embarrassed the heck out of the Imperials because they're like, two of our ace of ace pilots have defected. So, But let's talk about the Holocrons of Fate, because that's kind of important.
Yeah. Where do you want to start?
Well, there's a lot of beautiful details in this one that I really appreciate.
Yeah. So that's what I was saying about the Holocrons of Fate. I watched it all the way through and I was like, interesting. And then I started digging into all of the little mysterious Easter eggs. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, hold up. So should we start with the knowledge that was uncovered by the Holocron visions, or should we start with Caleb Doom?
So right before this, we watched the two previous speaking roles of Caleb Doom.
Okay, yeah. So I heard the name Caleb Doom, and I'm like, huh, that's weird. I don't think I've ever heard that name before. It does remind me of the name Cal Kestis, which I feel like I heard about in Tales of the Jedi.
You hear Cal Kestis from Jedi Fallen Order and Jedi Survivor.
Right. So I mixed up our two young ingenue Padawans. It turns out Caleb Doom was the name of Kanan Jarrus. We see him in first Tales of the Jedi in Practice Makes Perfect, which is the fifth episode where Anakin teaches Ahsoka to be the top 0.001% of Jedi fighters with a lightsaber.
So the important thing is not to get shot. Here, I'm going to teach you every single way to not get shot.
So Caleb Doom is sitting in the corner of Ahsoka's lightsaber trials, like holding himself back from clapping wildly because she's so good.
He's like, his popcorn is in the air.
Yes.
He's like, oh my God.
Mouth agog, popcorn flying, impressed beyond all belief. Then we see him in the premiere of The Bad Batch.
Yeah, he is the original Padawan who is running around and brings the Bad Batch up. And then we get to see Deepa Balaba's death in Order 66 as well.
So this kind of pieced together a bunch of puzzle pieces that didn't make sense for me when I watched the Bad Batch premiere. Because I remember thinking, boy, there's a lot of screen time for this rando Padawan. Boy, is his voice deep. Boy, is his inflection kind of weird. Then you watch grown-up Kanan Jarrus and you go back to the Bad Batch and you're like, oh, this is Freddie Prinze Jr.'s inflection.
It is, yes.
This is supposed to be, you know, baby Kanan Jarrus.
It is.
And it is. And he's delightful and he's spirited and he is respectful and he is just a perfect Padawan. And then Deepa Balaba dies.
And we talked about this in multiple times throughout Rebels, especially early on when he's like, I need to find someone who will teach you. I'll find Luminara. You know, remember that episode? Because he was taught by his master and he spends the first season and a half of Rebels so traumatized by those events.
Yeah, it makes the fact that Kanan is coming back to his Jedi roots now as a full-fledged grown-up more revolutionary. Because as I was watching The Bad Batch and watching Caleb run from Hunter and Crosshair and run from all of the regs, I was thinking how his world must have turned upside down in that moment. And the messages that he gets about the Jedi from then on are either they committed treason and they're not to be trusted, or they were too weak to stop themselves from being killed.
Yeah.
So, like, what reason would he have to go back to his Jedi roots? Now I see how Ezra being dropped on his doorstep must have been so frustrating. And he must have hated that.
Yeah, because he finally had to face something that he's been sitting on for like, what, 12 years at that point?
At least.
Yeah, well, because that day, the day of Deepa Balaba's death, isn't that the day of Ezra's birth?
Is that Ezra's birthday?
Isn't Order 66 and Empire Day the same day?
Oh, I think it's within a day or two.
Yeah, it's within a day or two. So that moment.
Brutal. Yeah. Yeah, so it makes his resentment and unwillingness to teach Ezra make so much more sense. And it makes me want to watch not only Bad Batch again, but it makes me want to watch Rebel Seasons 1 and 2 again.
Mm.
And really sit with Kanan battling himself, wanting to be there for Ezra and hating what Ezra is asking him to do.
What I love about this, I've gone back and listened to these episodes, the premiere of Bad Batch and also that episode of Tales of the Jedi. And I'm like, and there's Jedi Master Deepa Balaba and her Padawan, Caleb Doom, watching over everything. And you're like, cool, nice. And so like for me, having watched this episode of Rebels and then going back and watching those, I'm like, oh, that is so cool to interweave those characters back through the narrative to have it make a bit more sense. And anytime you are able to pull someone back, because Caleb also is referenced in one of the episodes of season 7, or there's like a flashback of him or something.
Oh, so, interesting.
Yeah. So they are able to take some of these characters and weave them together. And I think that's really cool. But that's just the start of things, because Maul is like, I don't care about who Kanan Jarrus was. I care that I have this delightful holocron. What am I going to do with it? What questions do you think Maul wants the answer to?
Well, okay, I had lots of questions about the holocrons bit. I guess my first question was that I thought Ezra's question was going to be, how do I overthrow the Empire? But Ezra's motivation and drive has really changed from season 1. So I'm going to turn a question back on you. When and why do you think Ezra's motivation changed from, I want to overthrow the Empire, to, I want to overthrow the Sith?
I think there's a twofold answer for that. One is Ezra's like slick. Ezra is he's not gullible. He's very rarely caught in someone else's trap. He often leads people along and they don't realize that they're also getting fooled. Like, Hondo. Like,
yeah,
most,
yeah.
Hondo is actually kind of scary unless you're Ezra, because
yeah, Ezra's got street smarts.
Yeah, he's got street smarts. That line of Hondo's, you know, Ezra's like, you were never gonna get paid. I was like, I'm so hurt and proud. You lied to me? I'm so proud. Like, Ezra just has that innately. And so Ezra believes that Maul is a Sith, but he also believes that Darth Vader is a Sith.
Because of the name Darth.
Yes.
Yeah. So as I was putting all of the pieces together, I was thinking, wait a second, Ezra wants to topple the Sith, but he doesn't know about Palpatine.
He does not know about Palpatine, but he does want to overthrow the Sith. And I think he believes that overthrowing the Sith will overthrow the Empire, but he also wants to poison the question for Maul.
So explain.
So Maul is like both, because the Bendu tells Ezra, because the Bendu, if you ask the Bendu question, it'll tell you.
He will answer. Yeah. It will be extremely informative and very helpful
and
very
useful. I don't know if I should have known that. I know if I want to know the answer to this question.
I mean, 100% better than a magic eight ball. Yeah. Why don't we just go to Bendu with everything?
Let's find out. But Ezra learns from the Bendu that a light side user and a dark side user, well, honestly, a Jedi and a Sith, or people who can think like them, open them up, they both get the answer to their question.
But Maul doesn't even ask a question.
I think that their minds are really connected. And Ezra realizes that that's the way it's going to work, because Ezra has been exposed to holocrons before. And he knows that, like, when he interacts with a Sith holocron, it's speaking in a horrifying, sexy voice. It's not perhaps speaking in a way that anyone else can hear.
So do you think Ezra wanted to ask any question that wouldn't help Maul, or was he specifically framing his question to be the question that he wanted to ask, but also unhelpful to Maul?
He was doing the latter. He was playing a
game. He was riddling a Sphinx.
He was riddling the Sphinx.
Ooh, Yeah. He's so good.
Yeah, I think that's what he's doing, because that's an answer that works for him. You know, he's like, I want to overthrow the empire, but honestly, at this phase of my life, after the events on Malachor, that's Hera's job. My job as a Jedi is to overthrow the Sith. I have to be separate from these politics because that is what my master taught me. And so I need to do Jedi stuff and she needs to do rebel stuff. And so he's like, how do I overthrow the Sith? But also, if I'm asking this question, I don't know what your question is, but I want to poison your question. And I say, well, and also, how do I defeat you? But it doesn't work because Ezra believes that Maul thinks of himself as a Sith. And as we discussed at the end of season two, I don't think Maul's a Sith anymore.
No, definitely not. He says it as much. He says, I used to know a lot about the Sith. Now I'm just a Force wielder.
Yeah. And I think Maul wants something so much more than what the Sith want, but also so much less.
So, okay, two questions. Let me do the first one about Ezra. Okay. And then I have a question about Maul. My Ezra question, is Ezra still a rebel?
Yeah.
Or is he a Jedi?
Oh, I think he's both. I think him and Kanan are still both. I think that they now act, I think they have specialized. I think this has happened to the almost all of the Ghost crew. At the end of season one, they roll in and they're like, Hera, you are now a rebel leader. And especially with the Antilles extraction, it's like, okay, Zeb is a special agent. Chopper is Chaos agent. Sabine is a special agent. They have their special missions that they do. Kanan and Ezra also have special missions that they do. And their missions are of the magical nature, because that is something that only they can defend the rebellion against. There are no other Force users in the rebellion.
But what do they think the tie is between the Empire and the Sith? Do they just see Vader working for the Empire and say, oh, the Sith are working for the Empire? Or do they think the Sith are the Empire?
I imagine that they've discussed this and they've perhaps decided that that's a difference without a distinction for them.
Oh, okay.
That like, if we open, perhaps the Empire is evil because it's run by Sith, or perhaps it's evil because it's an empire and is created by the Sith. But either way, it is a Sith-run empire. And so we can blow up their TIE fighters, we can raid their trading routes, and then Darth Vader will come up and blow up an entire rebel fleet. So we need to stop Darth Vader.
Okay, gotcha.
Because that's our job. And then Hera will run this interception mission and this relief mission. Zeb will clobber heads. Sabine
and
will...
And turn Imperial agents into honeypots who will do anything for him.
And Sabine will extract high-quality defectors, and Chopper will do Chopper things.
Like, I mean, that's a hell of a crew.
It is. It is. So I think that they've come into their own, and they're no longer random rebels. Now they're like heroes.
They are the Bad Batch of
the rebels. Yeah.
Of the rebels.
Yeah.
But the Bad Batch are kind of rebels.
Yeah.
Anyway, my Maul question.
Okay.
Sam, what does Maul want?
What do you think he wants?
WDMW. Hope is such a mysterious thing to wish for when you're Maul.
Okay.
So here's what I know about Maul. Maul got a super bad half-off special in The Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
Kenobi tried to kill him.
Yep.
Death evaded him.
Mm-hmm.
He spent 10 years festering in a lava pit on a garbage planet with spider legs.
It was like 2 years. Oh, no, it was 10 years because I was in Phantom Menace. Yeah. Oof.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
10 years festering with spider legs, gets yeeted off the garbage planet, finds his long-lost brother, gets the depression yeeted out of his brain, takes over Mandalore, loses his brother, gets new legs.
Gets new legs again.
Gets new legs again. Gets these legs. Gets yeeted by Ahsoka. Escapes, runs a crime syndicate.
Importantly, somewhere in there, also kills Kenobi's girlfriend.
Rip Satine.
Mm-hmm. And overthrows Mandalore, takes over Mandalore, runs it for a while, then Ahsoka yeets him.
Then runs a crime syndicate,
mm-hmm.
becomes Kira's boss. disappears into the ether, shows up on Malachor, mm-hmm. pretends to be an old man.
Has cobbled together a lightsaber out of Inquisitor parts.
Unlocks a Sith holocron, glibly says he's our apprentice now to mm-hmm. Ezra Bridger, escapes, and now what? What is he doing?
What is he doing?
What is he doing? What is that? What kind of resume is that?
Okay, so...
That is a Chaos Gremlin resume, Sam.
I don't think he's an agent of Chaos. I think he's lawful evil. So Maul knows... Who is on his kill list?
Kanan's eyes.
Okay, done. Check.
Satine.
Check. Palpatine, not going to happen. Because last time he went up against Palpatine, he had his absolutely massive galactic linebacker brother dissolved in front of him. And then he got shocked into submission for like 2 seasons. So Palpatine, unable to take him on. Vader doesn't really want to take him on. So who does he want to kill?
Kenobi?
Yeah.
So he's just going back to basics?
Yeah. Well, he's entered like the end of his life, you know? He's an old man now.
So he's still just fueled by revenge?
He always has been.
That's such a... Why would you run a whole crime syndicate if your goal was just to kill the one guy who almost killed you?
So was... Okay. He was running the whole Mandalorian crime syndicate for a long time in order to try to overthrow Palpatine.
Yeah, it feels like Maul is splitting his focus here.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like his priorities are all mixed up. He needs to keep his eyes on the prize.
And what is the prize for him?
I don't know.
Well, he
I don't think he wants to rule the galaxy. I think he just wants to kill Palpatine. So why does he bother with Kenobi?
Because Kenobi's the one who set him on this path originally. Kenobi's the one he wasn't able to defeat. He probably even looks at Vader, Anakin, and say, defeated himself. You know? Like, this is a dude who defeated himself. I don't need to kill him. He's already functionally dead.
I just feel like Maul is supposed to be cast as this character with single-minded resolve, mm-hmm. but his goals change all the time.
Yeah.
He is really mixed up. I don't know what to do with him.
Well,
Maul, get your act together.
I guess we'll find out now that he's running off on his gauntlet class.
Does he think that killing Kenobi will be a good practice sesh to get him ready to kill Palpatine?
Great question. So we've talked at length about this, about what Maul's all about, because he's not a Sith. You know, he knows a lot of the first, you know, couple of years of Sith training. And then he kind of practiced a different flavor of being a Sith. And honestly, in the history of Sith Lords, he would probably be up there successfully, except that Palpatine is like top tier. Compared to, you know, the Sith Lords of the past, Palpatine's very good because he's like, first I was in the shadows and I took everything over, and then I was open and in the shadows simultaneously and own the entire galaxy. And so you can't really be against that. And so what's Maul up to? I don't know. He's finding his own path. He sees that the path of Dooku sucks. He sees that the path of Vader sucks. And so he doesn't want to do those ones. The Inquisitors are like, you know, bumbling fools to him. So he is trying to carve a new legacy.
It feels like he is stuck in this idea that he had something until he lost all of it. And it is both Kenobi and Palpatine's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like he can restore his power by being less powerless by killing Kenobi. It's just that Maul, I look at Maul like a troubled, brilliant child, and I'm like, you have such potential. Why are you wasting your potential? I mean, he really has acted on a galactic scale, but he is driven by such petty goals. He could do so much more. Maul, what are you doing, baby?
Yeah.
Baby.
Interesting. It's also interesting that... the vision includes what will defeat the Sith.
Twin sons.
Mm-hmm.
We know some twins.
We know some twins. We know some sons.
We do know some sons.
Yeah.
S-O-N-S. Yeah, we do know some sons.
I was referring to S-U-N-S, but yeah.
We know some twins.
But either way, we've got a lot of useful information out of this, and I find that very interesting. But more shall be revealed pretty rapidly, actually.
Yeah. So before we move into the Antilles extraction, my final question was about the title of this episode, The Holocrons of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking about fate in Star Wars.
You know, fate's such an interesting concept because it's like impossible for someone to say that like such a thing was always fated to be. But in like the deep literary tradition of like Cassandra or Oedipus, of like you are fated to be doomed to fulfill a prophecy because you learned of the prophecy and then you're stuck in a loop, you know? I find that to be perhaps what they're talking about here, that the knowledge itself is dangerous because knowing it, like knowing something in the future is true, is horrifying.
Yeah. So we have a couple examples already in the canon of what we've covered on the podcast about people knowing what is supposedly destiny, What is supposedly destined, and thinking that they are on the path to that, and then it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So Qui-Gon suspects that baby Anakin is going to be the chosen one who brings balance to the Force.
Mm-hmm.
He does the dice toss with Watto on Tatooine, and Watto is like, oh, you want to free this slave? Let's let fate decide. Qui-Gon intervenes with fate to roll the dice in his favor to free Anakin. Is that the moment that he ruins the prophecy? Is that the moment that he intervenes with fate? I think Star Wars has this whole thing about predestination, But because people have free will, they're always butting up against their destiny.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering what the limits and bounds of destiny in Star Wars are.
Well, first of all, Watto never would have bet without loaded dice. Those were definitely loaded dice.
Okay, good point.
But secondly, we've talked at length about, especially when we read Master and Apprentice, which is the canon book about Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, understanding the future and prophecy might lead you down this path. And once you do, the knowledge is what traps you. And I think that's what the Bendu is trying to say too, that like, and this is the lesson that Kanan received in the temple on Lothal, is that you just need to prepare yourself. And if you are prepared, then you will take the right action. And if you are trying to make a certain outcome happen, you are doomed.
Yeah, so it bugs me a little bit in my egocentric Western independent viewpoint, because it feels like the lesson that Star Wars is trying to say is stop fighting against destiny. But I mean, you don't want to watch characters just bend before fate and say, okay, what's fated is fated. I will not intervene.
I think that's because the nature of this type of information is unclear. Like prophecies are always specifically unclear because the outcome is often different. Like someone will tell you, oh, you're the chosen one, and so we need to turn you into a Jedi. But what does that turn you into? You backlash. You go from being one of the greatest Jedi to being one of the greatest Sith over, you know, at the midpoint of your life because now you've reached balance. Like this idea of trying to interpret something in the future without actually understanding it is where the conflict arises.
Oh, so you're saying that Bendu might be counseling them to not seek the knowledge because they're going to try to interpret it and then they might interpret it badly?
Because, there's the episode where Ezra receives the vision of his parents, right? And then they end up beating Ryder Azadi. But the way he interpreted it was something that he really wanted. And that turned out not to be true at all, even once he started seeing those things. And he had the same vision when they ran into Gal Travis. And they're like, oh, it's just like my vision. And we should be rescuing this Gal Travis guy. And it in fact did work out for the rebels, but not at all in the way they thought.
Okay.
And so I think it's about the wanting
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
You think the Jedi are right. Stop wanting things so bad.
Yeah. And so that is why the Holocrons of Fate is so dangerous between Maul and Ezra when they're both using them, that they're both going deeper and deeper, searching for more understanding.
Hmm.
But.
Okay.
I mean, as far as Fate, I think that, like, the future collapses into a particle or a wave by observation, so you shouldn't observe it. Like, the observing is what locks it into stone. So if you know the future is written and it must be fulfilled.
Okay. So just leave it open-ended, you fools.
Yeah. Now, then you run into the existential question of, like, what if it's always been written into stone?
Yeah, so that's the fatalism that I'm fighting mm-hmm. against. Because, and then we can move on to Wedge. Because if fate is written in stone, then what is the excitement of watching the story unfold? Because no one's actions really matter.
Hmm.
Right? And that does not make for a good narrative, and it doesn't make for a good saga.
Only if you believe that outcomes are the only thing that matters, not the path, not the way they got there.
I believe that sometimes the purpose is the friends we made along the way, and the journey is important. But if you know how the story is going to end, how exciting is your story?
Well, it's how you get there. Books often start with, like, here's how the book ends, and then they tell you how you get there. I think that's really cool. But this is also the advice Yoda was giving to Ezra in the Temple on Lothal, is that, like, you can't win because the concept of winning is the wrong way to approach this. Like, you've already couched this argument in the wrong way of doing things. But Yoda also said, if you want to know how to defeat the Sith, you have to go to Malachor. And once they went to Malachor, they were able to pick up a Sith holocron and make friends with someone who knows how to use one. Well, friends loosely. Friends with someone who knows how to use it.
Friends ambiguous.
Then they were able to pull together the connection to actually learn the information necessary to defeat the Sith. Does that information even apply to Ezra and Kanan? Are they the ones to eventually defeat the Sith?
Or are they going to be able to figure out how to use the information in time?
Yeah. Is that information even meant for them? Like,
is that information even meant for them is such a good question.
Yeah. Like, if I went back in time and, you know, told 21-year-old me a bunch of hot stock tips, like, I wouldn't be able to do anything with it because I didn't have any money.
Yeah. Or, like, if I went back in time, I would be able to do absolutely nothing because I have no knowledge of history. I have no knowledge of medicine. I don't know how electricity works.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably make penicillin. That's about my limit of what I could do in the past with all of my knowledge of the future.
So it's like, that's how useful knowledge of the future is you going into the past and just being like, I have the answer to a very specific question. And then when someone asks you that very specific question, you answer them and you're like, oh, that was a kind of a stupid question because, and then you bip out of existence.
Yeah, so did we watch this cool, exciting, pointless episode for nothing?
All right, let's move on.
No, I'm serious. That was the question that I was left with as I was pondering how Star Wars seems to believe two conflicting things about fate.
I don't think it does, because they always say that it's about the journey. It's about the understanding. It's about the knowledge. It's not about the outcome. It's about, like, knowing the end doesn't make the story any less compelling. That's why historical stories are so interesting. This is what brings it back to, like, the legendary status of, you know, like, everybody dies at the end of the Odyssey. It's still an interesting tale. I mean, they all died 2,600 years ago.
Well, Star Wars happened a long time ago in a galaxy far away. So that's why Wikipedia is written in the past tense.
It is. And so everything already happened. And we're learning as it happened. And that's what makes it interesting. Knowing that Napoleon, you know, died on this stupid island in the Atlantic that he'd been banished to because he got banished like three times doesn't make the Battle of Waterloo or Borodino less compelling to learn about.
Sam's telling me not to be so utilitarian.
I am.
I'm listening.
Okay.
Speaking of utilities, It almost rhymes with Antilles.
Almost. So this is the first canon appearance of Wedge and Hobby. And I think...
Who are they?
They are named rebel pilots from the original trilogy. Wedge goes on to have like 9 books in the expanded universe. These are hotshot characters, and these are their backstories.
Cool.
Yeah. Which makes it a bit of fan service. There is pretty fun combat in these. It's cool watching the TIE Interceptors for the first time because they're scary. The first time we see TIE Interceptors in Universe Prime is in Return of the Jedi. And there is an absolutely bonkers scene at the Battle of Endor when a bunch of them fly forward. And 8-year-old me was just like, holy shinola. Like, what is this?
How do I get one of those?
Yeah, because they're way sexier than regular TIE.
How do I get me in one of those fighting for the rebellion?
And then another really fun little Easter egg for this one is that in the expanded universe, Wedge has a brother-in-law who is Baron Suntir Fel, which is a cool name.
Sounds familiar.
It's legends only. He is a TIE Interceptor pilot and then variously like joins the rebellion and then rejoins the Empire and like goes back and forth. But he's his brother-in-law at married Wedge's sister. And they have this like thing where they're fighting alongside each other and then against each other. They know each other's like flying styles. And it's very World War One, because in World War One, all the main actors, all the kings and queens were all cousins to each other. And so like, if you were a baron and you got to fly a, you know, planes were invented 15 years ago. So here's the top of the line fabric skinned tri-wing, like biplane, whatever, then you're probably flying against other people from other countries who are like your cousins or you are your distant relations. And so, and anyway, that Suntir Fel's paint scheme was the one that Volt Scaris has. It's some sort of like, I killed 100 rebels and all I got was this stupid paint scheme. But it's very cool to see how the Empire trains its elite pilots and that it probably runs into something similar to a lot of countries during World War II. That is where so much of the dogfighting of Star Wars comes from, is from like World War II.
Yeah, what this reminded me of was what Han Solo thought he was getting into when he joined up with the Empire. I feel like if he hadn't been such a...
If he hadn't been Han Solo.
If he hadn't been so himself, he would have ended up at Skystrike learning how to be a cool hotshot pilot. Yeah. However, he then got thrown out of Pilot Academy and had to be an on-the-ground mook, which sucks for Han Solo.
Yeah.
Feels like he brought it upon himself. But what I liked was getting a little bit of insight into what Sabine would have been doing when she was an Imperial cadet. Because she studied piloting, right?
No, she did not. She studied weapons.
Okay.
Yeah, which will become relevant at some point in the future. I mean, she knows how to fly. I think she's probably the second or third best pilot on the Ghost.
Hera has definitely been giving Sabine some after-school lessons.
I
because Sabine is doing really well. I was surprised or maybe interested because when Ezra infiltrates an Imperial Academy back in season one, we get a lot of the curriculum and we really see Ezra being a standout. But this episode doesn't give Sabine a lot of time to shine. She's just there long enough to find Wedge, say hello, and grab Rake and Hobby.
Yep.
I was a little bummed that we didn't get to see her excel.
Yeah. Well, it was a quick in and out extraction defection. You know, they finished the whole thing in the course of a few hours. So, yeah, it seemed like in the season one episode, that Ezra had been in there for like weeks. Yeah. So this is much faster.
Sabine rolled up, said, "Hey, Wedge, you look like a young Robert Sean Leonard, Dr. Wilson from House."
Okay. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah.
"And you're cool. Come on. Let's get out of here."
Here's a fun fact you may enjoy. The original actor for Wedge from way back in the original trilogy is Ian McGregor's uncle. And that's why Ian McGregor decided to try to take the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Oh, they're a Star Wars family.
They're a Star Wars family.
I love that.
So there are many, many fun fan service extended universe things in this episode that, like, if you read the Rogue Squadron and Wraith Squadron books and learn about Wedge, it's fun to learn his backstory of, like, flying cargo ships on Corellia and then joining up and being defecting to the rebels after joining the Empire, because that was a really common path.
And his friend is killed.
Who he tried to defect with. But defecting as a pilot is so intriguing. And it shows two interesting things. The rebellion never seems like, we've brought this up a couple times, and I guess it implants the idea in our mind. They aren't really worried about losing A-wings, but they are really worried about losing pilots.
Yeah.
And I don't think that has as much to do with, like, a soft-heartedness as it does with, like, A-wings are somehow easier to come by than pilots.
There's an interesting thing if you grew up in the South, the American South, like I did, where a lot of times on the news, if there's a natural disaster, like if a church gets blown over in a hurricane, mm-hmm. the local news reporters will come out and interview people, and they'll, like, find the pastor, and the pastor will be like, yeah, the building fell down, but the church is fine.
Mm.
The church being the people that make up the congregation. So it feels like the rebels have a similar idea about, sure, we can call up Leia Organa and have her deliver more hammerheads and go steal more Y-wings and A-wings, but talented pilots, I mean, it's the clone question back from the Clone War.
Ooh.
If clones don't have accelerated aging, mm-hmm. then it takes 18 years for a clone to grow up enough mm-hmm. to become a useful soldier. If we're losing pilots, it takes a long time to raise a pilot.
Yeah. I watch Perun's videos on YouTube. He's a defense economist from Australia, and he puts on these, like, 45 to an hour long PowerPoint presentations about defense economics and problems that are facing the world today. And it's fascinating. And one of them was about keeping pilots in the military today. And so he's talking about mostly NATO countries, but, like, it is expensive to keep highly trained people. Like, first of all, it costs millions of dollars to train a fighter pilot.
I think we get that in the Imperial Academy Sky Strike scene, because they have these extremely expensive simulation pods mm-hmm. in this massive facility to train three cadets.
At a time, yeah. And then you have to, like, keep them. And so a problem that faces people in our prime universe here is that, like, Delta or American Airlines is like, you have 10 years flying for the Air Force. How would you like to make twice as much flying 747s? They're like, yeah, bet. Like, that sounds great, honestly. Just, like, very easy work in comparison. And so keeping pilots and training them is actually on par with how expensive, like, the vehicles can be. And so by can be, I want to be very specific here. We live now in our prime universe in an era where airplanes are exceedingly expensive and designing airplanes is exceedingly expensive. But Star Wars harkens back to an era, and it always was, like, aesthetically World War I, World War II, especially in the Rebels era, where planes were not expensive and pilots were. And so I think that that is very much the vibe they're trying to get to.
Well, it makes sense with the rebellion too. The rebellion cares about life mm-hmm. and freedom. So it makes sense that they're less worried about their hardware and more worried about the beating hearts that fuel the rebellion.
Yeah.
So, like, I get all the arguments about, oh, rescuing these two hotshot pilots is really important because A, they're people, B, they're interested, C, we're running out of pilots, and D, they could be incredibly helpful to us. It's just they lost six pilots and replaced them with two. Mm-hmm. So how can you in good faith say the rebellion is growing?
Yeah, well, you're stopping the bleeding a little bit. And I think the Empire takes the Sky Strike defections more hard than the Rebellion does, because the Rebellion can apparently acquire enough pilots and A-wings to be running six of them around one of these transports on the regular. However, it just takes like three TIE interceptors to take them out. And if they make it more expensive to the Empire has these crazy economies of scaling as well. The Empire has a bajillion TIE fighters, but they also don't have that many really good pilots. A lot of those TIE fighters just get aced by, you know, Rex sitting there with his fuzzy dice in the cockpit of the Ghost. She's like, boom, 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 boom. Like, they kill a lot of TIE fighters, right? And so most of them suck, and a handful of them are good. And if you take the handful that are good and move them from one side to the other, that is a much more impactful thing.
Oh, it's like in chess.
It's a trade. Yes, exactly. Like what the Rebellion did was they traded a bishop for a queen.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, yeah, that's a good trade.
Okay, that's rad, actually.
Yeah.
That is very punk rock.
And so the Rebellion can't afford to do that a lot. But now they have done it's a fair trade for them as they perceive it.
Okay, cool. I love that. Let us take a few minutes to talk about the character we love the most this week.
Oh, it's time for Baywatch.
It's time for Baywatch.
Baywatch. All right. Who is your bay for this week's Baywatch?
Kanan Jarrus.
Good choice.
Slash Caleb Doom.
Slash.
Slash, I sat on the couch approximately 1 hour ago and watched baby Caleb Doom grow up in a heartbeat and cried. And I love him.
Watching the whole, I sat down with you and watched the intro to Bad Batch as well. And the watching the whole Bad Batch, including Crosshair, like hang out together is a tearjerker.
Oh, it's so good. I forgot also how beautiful Bad Batch is compared to Rebels. It's got that painter, gorgeous animation
style. It's like a whole next generation of quality. And they also picked that up for season 7 of the Clone Wars. And so Bad Batch looks really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Kanan being so traumatized, so young, it really finally resonated with me, because when I was watching Bad Batch and Tales of the Jedi and watching Order 66, I was like, okay, yeah, this is very, very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. And moved on because I was interested in what was happening next. And now having the context of a grown person who has lived their whole life in the shadow of that trauma, which is Kanan Jarrus, it finally landed with me and was as devastating as it was meant to be in the moment. And it gives me so much more respect for Kanan, which I've often struggled with on this podcast. I'm like, Kanan needs to step up. Kanan is not being a good dad. Kanan is not being a good partner. Why isn't Kanan being what Ezra needs him to be? And I'm like, oh my God, he is doing his best.
He's doing his best.
He is doing so good. Yeah. And he is really finally coming into his own in such a beautiful and gracious way.
Hmm.
And he is such a, I don't know, such a strong masculine figure.
Yeah. He's also really good in the Antilles extraction, because he's always telling Ezra, like, we can't survive that. Like, she trusts us, because Ezra is wearing a hole in the bulkhead, pacing back and forth. Like, I hate these solo missions. And Kanan's like, except when you're the one who's doing the solo stuff.
Which, if you'll remember, when Ezra infiltrated the Imperial Academy, that was Kanan.
It was.
He was so worried about his babe.
Yeah. And so now he's trying to impart that wisdom too. Watching season 3 Kanan having drastically increased his wisdom score is pretty cool.
It brings me great joy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And great admiration.
Mm-hmm.
Who did you pick?
I'm picking Sabine Wren.
Yeah. Also a great choice.
It is the season of Sabine.
The Sabizen for the season.
She does very little in Holocrons of Fate, but in Antilia's extraction, she's the star of the show. She puts it together. She is subtle. She's got the bluff. She's a good all-rounder whenever they throw her into a rebel situation.
And she goes hand-to-hand with Governor Price. And she's like, beats her up. Joke's on you. I learned jujitsu from my clan in the womb. Yeah. They were playing jujitsu tapes to me while I was in the belly.
Yeah, Mandalorians learn how to whoop butt before they learn how to read. So, boop. Yeah, she's great in that. I love that she embodies the rebel spirit because her and Wedge are sitting there on a gantry and she's like, we got to go now because Governor Price is here and we're under lockdown. And Wedge says, what's the plan? And she's like, I'll tell you when I figure it out. And he's like, are you serious? And she says, welcome to the rebellion, which is so true. But it also like seeing the difference between her and Wedge, because Wedge is like, you know, obviously rebellion curious, but also
young, handsome, and rebel curious, but, just the way we like him.
But he's also like, you know, he's been trying to do the right thing his whole life. And then we see that from Sabine's perspective. She's been trying to do the right thing her whole life. And it has led her to this position where she is like, hey, Ketsu Onyo, are you rebel curious? Hey, Wedge Antilles, are you rebel curious? Because I have a similar background to you, and it led me to here. And I think that that is actually one of the most amazing ways to convert someone, is to say, we went through the exact same thing with the same starting conditions, with the same knowledge. I wish to show you that there is another path outside of the ones you have looked at, and it is working for me and it can work for you.
Ooh.
And so Sabine is not always the exact right person to make a convert, but she's a great person in the right circumstances, because it turns out that even Zeb can get a convert, because Callus. Callus.
Can we extend a tertiary, non-marked, but still recognized.
We always have bonuses.
Bonus, yeah. Baywatch for Garezeb Aurelius, who I will say with resentment has done absolutely jack shiz this season. He has done
only four episodes in.
He has done nothing. He has not even really had a speaking line. However, his retroactive charm of Agent Callus really smoothed the road for our rebels today.
It did. Sabine would have had to kill a lot more people otherwise.
Agent Callus hearts Garezeb Aurelius, and that is canon. That is canon! It's here in the text!
They're even now. Anyway.
Callus-eb lives. Well, as I hang on the edge of my seat waiting to hear about the next exploits of my favorite ship, my favorite living ship, because Obi-Wan and Satine has gone down in flames.
It sure has.
What are we watching next week?
We are watching Rebels Season 3, Episodes 5 and 6, Hera's Heroes, and The Last Battle.
The Last Battle? That sounds awful.
Well, we're only a third of the way through Season 3, so it can't be that.
It can't be The Last Battle.
Yeah, all of the rest of them are just blank. Just blank.
Joke's on you. That's the end of Rebels.
So join us 3 weeks from now as we watch 45 minutes of paint dry.
If you love Growing Up Skywalker, you should follow along with us on social media. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, and Facebook. We're also having a heck of a good time on our Patreon, where for as little as $3 a month, you can listen to all of our bonus audio content. We are currently reaching the midpoint of Vision Season 2.
Mm-hmm. So join us there, join us everywhere, and send this episode to your favorite ship.
Or to me, because I have a favorite ship, and it is Callus-eb. And also, if you love Growing Up Skywalker, make sure to drop us 5 stars and write us a little love note on your podcast platform of choice, because it helps us grow our rankings and get in the earbuds of new listeners.
Sure enough. See you next week.
Talk to you next Tuesday.
Bye-bye.